Hello and welcome to Misbehave, the podcast where we explore human behavior in a business context. Season 2 of Misbehave is all about uncovering behavioral patterns which create success in life and business. We're joined by highly driven, accomplished individuals to assess their behavioral patterns and dive into how behaviors have influenced their journey. In today's episode, we talk with Spencer Gore, founder and CEO of the European Medical Journal, one of Europe's leading digital health communication companies. We talk about everything from balancing a business that is frequently ranked on the fastest growth lists, to keeping values front and central in every decision, to the importance of building a culture of gold medal winners. Well, welcome, Spencer. We are so pleased to have you join us today. I think we'll kick off with, you are a serial entrepreneur by your own admission, and you've been listed in the Times most ambitious business leaders. Tell us a little bit about what drives that ambition for you.
Hello, both. Good to be on the podcast. Thanks for inviting me. What drives that? I think it's just the competitiveness in me. I've always been incredibly competitive. I have this bizarre mindset that if I want to do anything, I can do anything. And, you know, going into the sort of the psychology, my mum as a kid used to say to me, you know, if you put your mind to anything, you can achieve it. And she used to say that relentlessly to me. And I genuinely believe that. I've had arguments with friends that I could be the number one golfer in Essex within 12 months if I wanted to be. And I don't play golf. It's that sort of bizarre belief that I have that I can achieve whatever I want to achieve. And I just need to make sure I focus on the right things to achieve that. So I guess that's what drives me, is I see an opportunity and think, well, I could do that better than someone else. So why don't I?
And how does that translate into the business for you?
In so many different ways. I mean, you've only got to look at our vision for the company. It's to create gold medal winners. So our mission is to elevate the quality of healthcare globally, which is one of the UN Sustainable Development Goals. Our goal is to become the go-to place for healthcare professionals, but our vision is to create gold medal winners in everything we do. And that's about being the best version of you. So whether you're someone in the team at EMJ and we're helping you to become the best version of you, whether you're one of our readers, one of our doctors that reads the journals, we're helping them become the best version of themselves so they can treat patients more effectively, or whether it's our pharma clients that work with us to make sure that their new drug that is the market lead for whatever it might be treating, they get to be gold medal winners in educating the physicians about this new drug, even right through to our suppliers and working with them and saying, look, you know, we want to have gold medal winners working with us. So you know, it's that whole, you become the sum of the average of the people you surround yourself by. So you become the average of the sum of your people you surround yourself by. So if you surround yourself by gold medal winners, that's going to rub off on you. So, you know, in terms of the business, we're always looking to be the best version of ourselves that we can be.
It's interesting, isn't it, when you talk about that reference, the gold medal winners, and you unapologetically talk about that with everybody in your space.
Yeah.
What happens if, for example, someone isn't performing as a gold medal winner, or you feel like you're not performing? How is that dealt with within the business?
Well, a number of ways. You know, like most companies, we have we have KPIs, but we've got four critical numbers that we think are the important things that drive our business forward. And then we have a number of KPIs that feed into that. You know, as a salesperson, I used to hate KPIs. It was just an excuse for me to get a rollicking when I hadn't done the work. But as I've got older and I've learned, I think KPIs are brilliant because for me, they tell me one of three things. If you haven't hit a KPI, it's because you're either lazy or you're having a bad day. You know, so if you're lazy, we don't recruit you. And if we do, you don't last very long. If you're having a bad day, I want to know why, and so that I can help you have a good day. And it might be that you had you got stuck in traffic and then you got splashed walking in, you know, whatever. You've had a bad day. Well, okay, we can help that. We can say, well, try coming in a bit earlier. Then you don't get stuck in traffic and walk away from the road so you don't get splashed, et cetera, et cetera. These things very rarely happen in our business because we recruit the right people. So they're very organized, they're very planned. So the reason you don't hit a KPI normally comes down to the fact that you've got too much work on. So we haven't got the resource for you to achieve that. So therefore, that tells me I need to get more resources in to help you achieve that. Or you haven't got the skills to do it. Therefore, it tells me I need to train you to get those skills. So we have our KPIs to measure whether you're performing or not. And then we take the right course of action depending on which one of those reasons that you haven't hit your KPI. Then it comes down to, you know, we use a quadrant when we're recruiting. There's people that have got the right skills and they've got the values. Well, they're the people we want to do everything we can to keep, and we push them to be gold medal winners. So we'll empower them, pay rises, promotions, whatever it might be. Then you've got people that have got the values, but they're not getting the results. So with those people, we'll train them, we'll retrain them. Eventually, they still might not be getting the results. We'll try them in a different position. So we've had people move from sales to client services, from finance to sales. And hopefully they then start getting the results, and then they move into the box where they're getting the results and they've got the values. Eventually, if they haven't, you have to get rid of them, but you do it in the nicest possible way. You say, look, you know, we've tried everything. You're just not getting the results here. Maybe this isn't for you, but you're a lovely person. You're aligned with us, so we'll help you get a job somewhere else. So we had a sales guy that was a lovely guy, just wasn't getting the results. He wasn't earning enough money, therefore, to lead the lifestyle he wanted. So we had a conversation and he left us, but he went and became a recruiter. And we started using him to do our recruitment because he knew all of our values. And he then ended up making more money from us as a recruiter than he did as a salesperson when he was working for us. So we did it in the right way. On the flip side, you've got people that haven't got the values and they're getting results. Well, actually, you're never going to change someone's values. So it doesn't matter what you do. You're not going to change them. So you have to get rid of them. And we do that very publicly in terms of we'll tell the rest of the team we've got rid of so-and-so because they weren't doing what we expect them to do. And so therefore they're making your life harder than it should have been. You're having to cover for them. And you know, if you've got that rowing boat of eight and there's only seven of you sitting in the boat, you're still going to row quicker than if there's eight of you and one of you is rowing in the wrong direction. And then the fourth quadrant is you don't have the values and you don't get the results. Well, hopefully we don't recruit you in the first place. That's what our recruitment process is for. But if you do, you know, they don't pass probation.
Yeah. The critical number piece, I just want to touch on that bit because weirdly enough, Laura and I have been talking a lot in our business plan and strategies personally around making sure the team are linked to the critical numbers. And it's great having that distilled down into KPIs, personal KPIs, but are they really clear about what maybe the one or the two, three, four, I think you said you had four critical numbers where the team are really connected to that and rowing in the same direction? And I think there's a lot to be said about that being really, really clear and very focused and revised as each quarter, you know, as and when you need to.
Yeah, so we've done a lot of work over this over the years. We set our annual critical numbers, the four numbers that we think are going to drive the business forward, and we set the targets around those numbers. And those numbers won't probably change for us now for the next 5 years. The actual things we're measuring, the targets will change. We sit down with the leaders of the teams who have spoken to their teams and decide what are the right numbers for the business. And then, as I said, every single person's KPIs feed into those so that they know at the end of each day if they've helped us move forward as a business or not. And we have a Monday morning huddle at 8:30 where everyone in... So we have about two-thirds of our company is in the office most days. And so they'll all stand around and the rest of the people dial in and we'll talk about those critical numbers. The first thing we do is how we've done this week compared to last week on those critical numbers. Every time they change throughout the week, that gets updated and there's a dashboard available to every single person in the company that can see that. And then we do a newsletter on a Friday at 5 o'clock that updates where we are with the critical numbers. And we talk about successes and other stuff in there as well. But the very top thing is the critical numbers. So you have to live and breathe them. Everyone has to understand what they're doing and how it impacts the business.
Do you feel like, you know, with that process, how do you manage engagement with those numbers? Because obviously we know people are motivated by different things, right? So how are you rolling out engagement with those numbers so that every different type of person can find a way to resonate with that and be motivated by it?
So in terms of how we get the engagement, I think part of it is down to how we communicate it. We do an email, we do a verbal communication in terms of the huddle. So you've got to communicate in different ways. We have it visual for the people online in the week. But really it ties into the vision for the business and the mission for the business, which is elevating the quality of healthcare globally. So we have our values. You know, it's a long story, but we had our 10 value words and we realized that actually if I say to you one of our values is hardworking, your definition of hardworking could be very different to mine. So we had to put some meat on the bone and explain what it meant. And over probably an 8-year period, we've developed so that EMJ, which is the journal, is part of the European Medical Group. So we've got EMG and our values. We have our three value statements, which start with EMG. So it's entire buy-in. So that means you've got to be entirely bought into what we're trying to achieve as a business. And if you are, we'll be entirely bought into helping you become a gold medal winner. The M is the version we use, which, sorry if it offends any listeners, but is make sure you look after your own shit. So do your job and do it properly. And then the G is go the extra mile. Once you've done your job, See if your teammates need any help. See if your clients need any extra help. See if our suppliers could do with any help. But you have to do it in that order. You have to be really bought into what we're trying to do. Then you have to do your job first, and then you go the extra mile. We've got a team of really nice people, and it's in their nature to want to help people first. So it's like, oh, I can help you do that. And he's like, no, do your job first. Otherwise, you get to 5 o'clock and you've helped everyone else. Now you've got to do your own job or it doesn't get done. So you have to do it in that order. So the entire buy-in means that everyone is really bought into elevating the quality of healthcare, which means those critical numbers are really aligned with what they want to do. Then the other thing we do is in a sort of one-to-one situation, we ask everyone in the company what their BHAGs are. So what's their big, hairy, audacious goal? What are they working towards? And it might be, I want to buy my first house or my first car. I want to travel the world. I want to become a such and such. We then put plans in place to help them achieve that and say, look, if you do this in the company, when the company gets to this level, we'll be able to help you do this. So we've had people that have bought their first houses, first and second houses through working with us. People that have bought their first cars working with us. One of the guys that works with us, Darren, he came to me earlier this year and said, he's talked about it for years, but we've known about it. But he said, look, this year I'm going to set up my racing team. He wants to have an auto racing team. And we put a plan in place and he's now entering his first race and he's going to do 7 races this year. And the car is sponsored by EMJ. So we've helped him do that because we knew what his BHAG was. We knew that if he was really bought in and driven, he's going to achieve a hell of a lot more for us and therefore for him than if he's just coming in 9 to 5 to do his normal job that he's not really bought into.
Which in our terms, I suppose, if you look at your behavioural profile, there's no surprise to say that your primary motivation is achievement, but you're also really high in goal. So those goals are really important. So as you're describing the critical numbers and knowing where you're going and the vision, and the big picture bit is like you being able to see that vision and create it. But what you're doing a great job in, if you don't mind me saying, is connecting the people with that.
Yeah.
And that's often where people who are entrepreneurial, who have the traits you have and Laura and I both have, it's actually being able to distill that down to make it make sense to the people in the team and connect it to their motivation level. So, you know, if you're more people-driven, your BHAG, personal BHAG, might be more people-centric. If it's more achievement, it might be more career-focused or number-driven, a sense of achievement moving forward. If you're more power-driven, and in the terminology that we use, that's more like, it's more important about having a lead or leading something or having control over something. And I think having those personal BHAGs is actually a lovely tip, because often in businesses, they'll have the BHAG for the business, but not necessarily distill it down to a personal one. I think that's actually it's a lovely piece for connecting with individuals within the business.
Yeah, they haven't created that link through, I think, the way that you're describing it there.
I'm working with a coach out in America. I've been working with him for the last year or so, and it's part of an association I've been working with for some time. And they talk about the PPFs, what are your personal, professional and financial goals. And they do a PPF meeting, I think once a month, if not more, with everyone in the company. But instead of a one-to-one, a classic one-to-one, they'll have a PPF meeting to say, you know, what are your 1, 3 and 5 year goals from a personal, professional and financial, you know, perspective. And then they help them work towards that. And you know, we've got a number of people in the company have always said to us, look, are you ever going to open up abroad? We'd love to work abroad. Well, we've opened up a company in America this year. We've got our first office opening July the 1st. 4 of our team are moving out there. So we're going to grow it in America as well. But 4 people that really showed an interest in wanting to go and work and live in America are now going to do that. We've helped them fulfill a dream because it's a win-win. You know, they want to do it. We want to do it. So why wouldn't we do it?
If you're curious to know more about your leadership behaviours, click the link in our show notes to get 20% off a leadership DNA profile.
So we've discussed there a lot of the successes, Spencer, and like how you've connected to that. Can you share with the listeners some of like the biggest challenges that you've faced over your career?
Yeah. Christ, where'd you start? I love challenges because my favorite ever quote is Nelson Mandela's, I never lose, I ever win or learn. And I look at a challenge as just an opportunity to get better. So yeah, we do this thing called Johari's window where you sit and reflect on and look at what you're good at, what you're not good at, and then someone else looks at what you're good at and what you're not good at. So you can find the little space that you don't know what you're good at and they don't know what you're good at. You want that as small as possible, because if you know what you're not good at, you can improve it. So for me, some of the challenges have been, I guess because I'm very goal driven, I get really frustrated that we're not growing faster than we should be growing. Because I look at this opportunity and think we're at 10% of where we should be. So rather than looking at the 10% we've done, I look at the 90% we haven't done. So I get really, really frustrated with things like that. Recruitment is a big challenge for us because we recruit people based purely on their values. The competency, we can teach them to do the job, but we'll never change their values. So we're fishing from a much smaller pond. There's, you know, that many people out there, and the people out there that have got our values is that big. So that ties in with my frustration levels that I can't recruit quick enough. That's part of the reason why we haven't done the 90%. We've only done the 10%. Two, on a personal note, challenges for me is I hate conflict. I avoid conflict at all costs. I really hate conflict. I would much rather just let something stew over there, but then it gets to a point where I get frustrated and I just act on it quite sort of swiftly when I do act. So it's a bit like, yeah, I'll suddenly rip the plaster off. And I guess that, you know, talking of behaviours and values, I was thinking about this before the call. I think a behaviour for me is something that you can learn and adapt to if you need to. I think a value is the same sort of thing, but it's ingrained in you from childhood. So, you know, my parents taught me to brush my teeth every day when I was a kid. So I don't think about it now. I just brush my teeth. You know, I would never suddenly stop brushing my teeth. A behaviour, I think, is something that you learn later in life, or you can learn at any point in life. But a real challenge for me growing up was timekeeping. I was awful at timekeeping. It didn't have any importance to me whatsoever. So I would turn up late for everything. And I'm going back to pre-mobile phones, where if you were meeting your mates, you could just say, sorry, I'm late, where are you? You know, we had to meet people at certain times. And if you weren't there, you missed them. And I was so bad at timekeeping. My mates used to say, you know, are we meeting at 6:30? Is that 6:30 or is that 6:30 Spenage Mean Time? Because it would always be an hour later. And when you're running a business, you just can't. Well, I've not found a way of running a business successfully when you're not disciplined. So I've had to learn that skill or that behavior and adapt to it. But it's not me and my natural self. So I think, you know, on the behaviors thing and the challenges thing, you learn to adapt to a lot of your challenges, even though they're not your natural persona.
Yeah, we talk about them. So when with someone's profile, what we'll look at is where you've got big spikes of colour and big strengths, which you've got a lot of that. And typically entrepreneurs have much bigger spikes in different directions. But then on the flip side of that, there's, we call them blind spots, because actually usually they are blind spots. But as you become more senior, you can become more conscious of those blind spots. So you then, really what you're describing there is, that's not my natural state, but what I've learned to do is balance that, or just be more aware of what my approach needs to be in those different situations.
Yeah, definitely. And I think there's two ways I've dealt with it. One is knowing about those blind spots. And when I was maybe younger and didn't have the resources, I would have to adapt and become a bit of a jack of all trades, so to speak. Whereas now we're a bigger company, I look to recruit people that have got those skills. So you look to, you know, everyone has the buzzword around diversity. For me, the most important thing in diversity is cognitive diversity. You want to make sure that everyone can do everything. If you recruit people that just have the same skills as you and just do the same jobs as you, you're never going to cover those blind spots. So it's about, for me now, if I know I'm not very good at the detail, I get someone in to do the detail. If I'm not very good at something else, I'll get them in to do that. So I've adapted a little bit over time as we've got bigger.
And you know, you'll always have blind spots because your subconscious drives a lot of your behaviour, so those blind spots aren't going to go away. I just wanted to dive a little bit more into that conflict piece, because it's really generous of you to share that, because it's quite a personal piece around, like, actually saying I avoid it. And we do a lot of work around, because, you know, conflict is part of a behaviour. We do a lot of work around looking at how do you make sure you're mining for productive conflict, particularly at leadership level, and how do you stimulate that debate? If you have got diversity of thinking in a boardroom or a leadership team, how do you make sure that you're okay with disagreeing in the room and stimulating that debate? How have you managed to get around that, Spencer?
Well, first of all, I tend to be very open. The guys know in here, if they want to know something, they just ask me, because I'll tell them. I'm rubbish with secrets. I've got a really poor memory, so I can't lie, because I never remember what I've lied. So I just I just tell them everything. But I perhaps didn't word that very well in terms of I don't like conflict. I love constructive conflict. So, you know, I'm sure you've read Five Dysfunctions of a Team by Patrick Lencioni. It all comes down to trust. If you trust each other, then you can have those debates and argue and debate, whatever you want to call it, all day long behind closed doors, And as soon as you walk out that door, we're all agreed on what we've agreed, and we don't go behind each other's back and do it. We talk about that all the time. All the leaders have to read Five Dysfunctions of a Team, and that trust thing we spend, you know, I'm taking them all out, not all, I'm taking 12 of them out for dinner, the leaders, tomorrow night. We do that on a monthly basis just to build trust. You know, once you see them in a different setting rather than the office. So we put a huge amount of work in trust. I had 7 of them out in Miami at a conference with me the week before last to build trust. So it's not so much the positive conflict in work I don't like. It's the, if someone's just done something wrong, you know, if you're like, what the hell did you do that for? It's the sort of the headmaster type discipline I really can't stand. I really hate that sort of, when I know there's going to be an argument, and it's an argument that you might think that's right, but it's not acceptable at EMJ. We can't do that. And it's those sorts of things that I really hate having. And I avoid like the plague. Even when we have to let someone go now, I don't do it unless I really have to. Partly because there's a team in place to do that. But I didn't set up a business to sack people. I set up a business to create opportunities for everyone. You know, one of our sort of unofficial value after the EMG is having fun. You know, we do our interview process, telephone sort of call just to check that they're the right person, you know, right sort of CV, and they've made a mistake in what they're applying for. Then we do a competency interview to make sure they've either got the skills, or more importantly, they've got the ability to learn the skills, because we can teach them that or send them on a course. Then we do the values part of it to make sure they're aligned with us. And then we have like an unofficial part, which is the, if you're told you're sat next to them at the Christmas party, what's your immediate reaction? Is it, ah, or is it, ah, good? Or if you're told you're going on a business trip with them, is it, ah, or is it? And that for me is so important. You know, I live by the one life, love it motto. And I want to enjoy every minute of my life if I can. I don't want to be working with people that I don't get on with. So it's got to be fun. So when you've realised you've made a mistake and you've got to get rid of someone, that's just the worst part of my job. I hate doing that. It's just, why would you want to do that? It's not a nice thing to do, is it? So it's that sort of conflict I'm talking about.
And I think what's really interesting is lots of people talk about how it's really difficult to get rid of people who aren't a values fit. And often that's because they haven't got clarity around their values and people aren't clear with it. But I actually think, listening to what you're saying, it's almost, it's harder, arguably, to get rid of someone who is a value fit.
Exactly.
But there are other things that are at play because you genuinely like them.
Yeah.
The likelihood is they're trying really hard. You know, they're not just deliberately not performing. And that becomes a much more difficult conversation when you have a really strong culture.
Exactly that. Yeah. When we first started bringing the values in, we had a guy that worked for us. And he was, so it's a little story that we had 3 guys in our sales team that sat on the same table. 2 of them were bringing in £300,000 a year, and 1 was bringing in £30,000 a year. Long story short, we sacked the 2 that were bringing in £300,000 and kept the 1 that was bringing in £30,000. He's now been with us for 7 years and brings in over £1 million every year. The reason we got rid of the 2 that were bringing in £300,000 is because they didn't have our values. One of them went on holiday, and as he's leaving the office at 5 o'clock on Friday, says, oh, by the way, I'll see you in 2 weeks. You're going to have a problem with this client because I balls up here, but you can deal with it. I'll be sitting on the beach drinking a pina colada, and walked out the office. And we were like, what an ass. You know, that's not our values. And so getting rid of him was really quite easy because he just didn't fit in with us. And it was like, you're not going to be happy here. We're not going to be happy having you here. You might be bringing us in a decent amount of money, but there's more to life than that. As you said, it's when we've got the people that potentially are bringing in £30,000, but they're a really good fit for us. Once you've tried to retrain and and they're still not getting results, then you've moved them to a different department, they're still not getting results. That's when it's really hard to get rid of someone, because you know they're a really nice person. Yeah, they've got not a bad bone in their body. They've tried really hard. That's a horrible position to be in. Really horrible position.
You're saying that really blasé though, Spencer, but there will be people listening thinking, yeah, if I had someone bringing in that kind of money and maybe the business was relying on that money coming in at that point in time, and if they sacked that person, cash flow would be massively impacted, the business might be in jeopardy, maybe that income is absolutely critical for paying the rest of the staff. Those decisions aren't easy decisions to make. You have to have quite a lot of gumption to be able to do it. You know, sometimes you put in a position, we've seen it with some of our clients, where it's a conundrum. Yeah. And it's not an easy choice, even though that value piece, you know it's the right thing to do. Maybe sometimes people can't actually make that decision because of the financial constraints.
Yeah. No, you're right. And you're right, I was blasé with that. I can sit here and be blasé because it was 8 years ago and I know how it panned out.
No, I was meaning you were saying it so relaxed and yeah. Like, I just don't want the listeners to misinterpret that because, like you say, that was a long time ago. But also, it is commendable to be so clear about that value fit and know long term it's not going to work because that person wasn't going to work out long term, and to nip it in the bud before potentially was making even more money for the business.
And I think that's where you've got to have that. You've got to have that real commitment to values, haven't you? And I think we definitely battle with that when we are going out and I suppose prospecting more than working with clients, and we deliberately work with people who value things like best places to work, investors in people, you know, because we know the benefits it brings, but actually it's often intangible in some ways. And I think if you're a person where all you look at is a hard-lined number, you are going to struggle to get rid of somebody that's bringing in 300 grand if they're not a value fit. Whereas if you look at the bigger picture and you say, you know what? What's that going to cost me? Okay, it's not going to be as tangible as that 300 grand, but I can tell you it's going to cost you way more than 300 grand to keep somebody in the business that's not a value.
Without a shadow of a doubt. You know, you've just got to look at the way we've grown as a business. And yeah, we were on the Times 100 fastest growing businesses a couple of years ago. We were on the FT 1000 fastest growing businesses in Europe last year. That's because we recruit on the values. Our revenue has gone up every single year for the 12 years we've been running because of the values, not despite the values. The best example I can think of is the analogy of, you say, where what if I pay for this person to be trained and they leave? Well, what if you don't pay and they stay? And it's the same sort of thing. You know, if you've got someone that hasn't got your values and they're bringing in 300 grand, but you might have someone else that has got your values that's bringing in 400 grand, well, if you keep the person that's bringing in 300 grand, what sort of message are you sending to them? That is, yeah, we don't really care about what they do as long as they're bringing in money. Well, then the person that is the right fit for you goes, well, this isn't the sort of place I want to work at. And then they leave. So by keeping the 300 grand, you might lose the 400 grand. Or in our case, we might have lost Max that brought in 30 grand, but has now probably brought in over 5 million quid for us since that day. Because he said, well, I don't want to work with these people. If you're going to be like that when you go out the door on holiday, it's not the sort of company I want to work for. So it's, you've got to look at what's the risk of keeping them rather than what are you losing. We went for a spell around then where we'd gone real sort of gung-ho for growth, and we'd got up to about 50 people at that stage. And we, you know, it was around then we started looking at the values and we were like, these people just aren't right for us. They're not aligned with what we're trying to do. You know, we'd get to 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock when everyone had gone home, and we'd sit there for an hour moaning about all these people, and we're like, well, we're just now wasting an hour of our lives at 7 o'clock in the evening moaning about these people. So we literally culled, for want of a better word, half the company. We went down to 25 people in a quarter, and then the following quarter we had our best ever quarter financially that we'd had with half the people, because all of a sudden everyone was just positive and pulling in the same direction, and we spent that extra hour where we'd been moaning about them growing the business. And it was just, we were inspired by the people that we'd kept. They were inspired because we created that atmosphere, and it's just been like that ever since. You don't, you know, it's not foolproof by any means, but it's, when you're actively trying to do that, you'll find you've got a much better fit with most people in the company.
And I think people, they don't appreciate that. I mean, we often will call them internal terrorists. You know, they infiltrate the entire business, not even people that they sit next to or that they work closely with. It's the entire business. And I think that, you know, going back to the Pat Lencioni thing of that piece around, if you've got a team that comes together, that rows in the same direction, you can dominate any market in any industry at any time. And I think that's really the value of that. Tell us a little bit about how, Spencer, you test that value fit at interview.
Yeah. So just on that last thing on that, you know, you've got to be really, really strict on it as well. You know, if someone's almost there, you've got to say, well, they're not there. Because if you're heading in that direction as a boat and everyone's going in that direction, you go in that direction. If one person's slightly, just 1 degree off, by the time you get up here, they're like that. And then, as you say, then start telling everyone, oh, it's not quite right here and blah, blah. Then the people that were aligned suddenly be like, hang on, maybe it's not aligned. And so you've got to be really strict on it. So our process, as it stands now, is, as I say, we have a telephone, then a competency. Then we have two of the senior leaders in the team doing a values interview. So one asks all the questions and the other one doesn't speak other than hello and, you know, until at the end when they ask a few questions, because they're just literally making notes. They want to focus on making notes, because if you're asking questions, you sometimes miss what the person being interviewed is saying. And it's basically an hour-long interview, and it starts off, we'll ask them to tell us a little bit about how they were brought up, you know, whether it was mum and dad or aunt or uncle or whoever it was, because if their dad was really hardworking, the chances are they're going to be hardworking, because that's all they've ever known. If, you know, my dad, when I grew up, ran his own business. So for me, setting up my own business was never really a big challenge. It's all I'd ever known. Whereas I talked to my cousin, and she's in the police force, and her uncle was in the police force, and she's like, I don't know how you can run your own business. I'm like, I'm not sure how you can be in the police force, because it's what you've always known. So we want to understand a little bit more about their upbringing to understand how that's influenced them and those values have been ingrained. We'll then ask them a series of questions from their highest level of education, whether that's university or A-levels or GCSEs, whatever it might be. And then we'll ask them about their first job, their second job and their third job, if they've had three jobs, obviously depending on the level. And the questions are very repetitive. You know, we ask the same questions for each stage of their career in terms of what would your boss say were your strengths and weaknesses? Not what would you say, but what would your boss say were your strengths and weaknesses? What was a success? What was a failure? And we ask these same questions all the way through because we're looking for patterns. You know, I could say, well, my boss would say timekeeping was a weakness. Well, you might say, well, okay, if you haven't got very good timekeeping, I don't want you. But if you then say at the next job, what was your strength? Oh, I was always early because I took on board the feedback I got and I learned from it. Or if you say, well, actually, timekeeping, I was always late again. You're like, well, you're not taking feedback and learning from that. So you have to look at the series of questions rather than just one-off answers. And then we ask them some random stuff that is just really to see how they think on their feet. So it's, you know, why shouldn't we hire you? And that always catches people out. And it's, you know, it's just to see how they're reacting under pressure. We'll ask them a question, you know, if you win the lottery tonight and it's topped up every night, so you go out and spend money and you give money to your charity and you give money to your family and you buy a nice house and you go traveling, what gets you out of bed the next day? And they'll say, well, I'll give some more money to charity. Okay, well, you're going to get bored of that eventually. Once you've done that, what's going to get you out of bed? So you're trying to find out what their real passion is.
Yeah, what they're motivated.
And what their motive is. Yeah, because if you don't need money, why do you get out of bed? You know, someone said to me, what would you do if you sold your business? And I was like, I'd go and have a holiday for a week or so, and then I'd set up another business because my passion is running businesses. So it's trying to find out what they're really driven by. And we'll ask them, you know, what are your 1 year, 3 year, and 5 year goals? Oh, actually, I just sort of take each day as it comes. That's great, but you're probably not going to work for us because we're very driven about hitting goals. So, yeah, what we say is your values are right for you and mine are right for me. There are no wrong values. But if they're not aligned, it's not going to work. So we're just trying to work out if we're aligned. We're not trying to judge them on whether they're right or wrong. We're just trying to see if it's going to work with EMJ because we do things in a certain way.
And I think that totally links with the behavioural stuff that we do in the sense that often people use our profile as part of the recruitment process because the behaviours underpin the values. And often, you know, we say, similar to what you've just said there, this is about making sure you're going to be the right fit for you as well as us looking. It's a two-way street because we want you to be happy. We want you to have that spring in your step when you come to work and we want you to perform. And I think the behavioural stuff is so much more difficult to judge because everybody's on their best behaviour, right? Usually in an interview. And having some of those questions that you're not really able to practice, you're not able to rehearse, I think is super, super important. Looking at your behavioural map, you know, you've got a profile that tells us got a massive bias for action. You like to juggle lots of different things. You love variety. And you also really love to almost disrupt change and be, you know, you're a change maker. How do you manage yourself not getting drawn into too much of the shiny new things and wanting to be ahead of the curve on everything? You know, this podcast is called Misbehave. I'm interested to know how difficult you are to work with and how you manage that.
You have to ask someone else that question. I think I'm brilliant to work with. I'm a nightmare to work with, I think. I'm all over the place. Yeah, I do love shiny toys. And what I love is looking at opportunities. So, you know, this is a learned behaviour. I'll look at challenges and see, okay, well, this is an opportunity to do something differently. This is an opportunity to change what's not worked and make it work. So I'm always looking at how we can do things differently. I work with a mentor, a lovely guy called Steve Clark, for years. And his big thing, and he had it on his board behind him, was WTF. And that's all he'd ever say to me. And it's not what you'd think it stands for. It's where's the focus? You've got to be focused. So the way I've sort of adapted, I guess, is I try and reverse engineer what we're doing at EMJ. So we have our destination. So we've got our five-year goal. And, you talk about shiny toys. We've currently got 3 businesses. My five-year plan, there's 12 businesses, all connected.
Of course there is.
And by the time we get to 5 years, that will probably be 20 businesses. But I know where I'm heading. So the reference I use is I've got a sat-nav. Now, my sat-nav, I type in Edinburgh, let's say, and I know that if I'm really focused, I could go straight up the M1 and whatever the most direct route the sat-nav says is, and I do that. And I know there might be some roadblocks and we have to do a few diversions. And the way I look at it is, actually, that's really boring and we want to have fun. I talk about fun and I might get distracted by shiny toy, shiny toy, shiny toy. So I want to go the country route. I want to go all around the country route, see all these lovely sights, but I want to do it in an open top Ferrari as fast as I can. So I still want to be really fast growth and having that action, but I want to just be able to go where I want to go. But I always know wherever I've gone, wherever I've diverted off to, I'm still going to Edinburgh. So that I've always got that North Star, if you want to call it, that I'm working towards. So at the end of the day, is this going to help us elevate the quality of healthcare globally? Is this going to help us become the go-to place for healthcare professionals? Is this going to help us create gold medal winners? If it ticks yes to those, then there's a pretty good chance I'll do it, whether it's in our plan or not. And that, you know, we've got to be agile. During COVID, we launched 2 new products that we'd been talking about doing for 5 years because we hadn't needed to. And all of a sudden we needed to. And so we're like, we're doing it. So you've got to be agile to be able to do that. We shouldn't have taken 5 years to get there in the first place. But we decided within a month we were going to launch these 2 new products. And it became our best-selling product that year, even though we didn't launch it till March or April, wherever it was in COVID. So you've got to be able to do that. So you can't just religiously stick to this plan that says we're going to do this because you don't know when there's going to be a COVID or you don't know when there's going to be a Brexit or a war in the Ukraine or whatever the next challenge is. You've got to be able to adapt to these things. So I think being able to adapt and see shiny toys and do stuff like that is a real strength, and you need to be able to do that. Otherwise, you end up saying, yeah, no one's going to do this online video streaming stuff. Let's keep doing videos and DVDs, and you become Blockbuster Videos.
Yeah. It's being able to see, isn't it, what's coming. And I think that's what Blockbuster didn't do.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't see Netflix coming. They didn't see what that looked like and they missed that and it was catastrophic. So it's how do you keep that eye on that?
Yeah, but because they were worried about failure. They just thought, well, actually, if we try that and it doesn't work, we've failed. So let's just keep doing what we know works. Whereas I'm a big believer in, you know, when I first started in sales 20-odd years ago, it was telesales, and I'd pick up the phone, call someone, and they would say no. And I'd do that 99 times in a day, and then I'd get one yes, maybe, if I was lucky. And my boss used to just say to me every single call, don't worry, you're one call closer. And it was that you're going to get there eventually. It's a numbers game. So the more times you get a no, the quicker you get to a yes. And that's how I look at business, is that we're going to try 10 new things every week, every day, every month, whatever it is. 8 of those are definitely going to fail. But the 2 that work, one will probably be quite good and one will be really good. So the quicker we have the 10 ideas that fail, the quicker we get to the ones that work. So failing is a great thing. I can't remember the stats now, but you look at Dyson with his bagless vacuum. He tried something like 2,000 attempts before he got that right. Well, if he'd given up after 2, he wouldn't be the billionaire that he is now. So it's shiny toys are a great thing if you can manage them properly. So I'm lucky, or I hate the word lucky, I'm fortunate that I've got a team around me that help me manage this and they keep me on track with certain things. If I have a shiny toy plan, they can take it off my hands as soon as it's not shiny anymore because I've had it for a week or whatever. And yeah, so.
And that's the key. It's putting those people around you, isn't it? Because yeah. What your patterns tell us, and listen, it takes 2 to know 1 because we're both pretty much where you are on this. So, but you know, those behaviours do drive not the best complete and finishing. It's like, okay, I'm bored with this now. But if you've got people around you that can do that follow through, I mean, it's like everything. It's like, how do we build teams around us that support with that? I'm interested to know, to wrap up, Spencer, because you've given us some really great insight into the business. I'm interested to know about you. One is one thing that people might not know about you.
Well, I don't know that they'd necessarily be surprised because I'm quite open about this. But one thing that you wouldn't necessarily expect with someone in my position potentially is that I'm dyslexic. I found out 5 years ago I was dyslexic. So not many people know this actually. As part of the assessment, I did a half day assessment and I had to test all various different things. And one of the things that came out of it is my short term memory is in the bottom 1% in the country. So I have an awful short term memory. As I said, this is why I can't lie because I forget what I've said. So I learned to adapt with that. rather than being assessed as a kid. And so what you find out when you start looking into this is, in America, 80% of people on death row are dyslexic. In the UK, 60% of self-made millionaires are dyslexic. So there's two paths that you can go down, because generally if you're dyslexic, and I'm making, I don't know if there's evidence to back this up, so don't quote me on this, but I think if you're dyslexic, you end up being a bit disruptive in school because you can't learn in the traditional way. So I left after a year of A-levels because I didn't like school. And then I worked for a year, then I went back and redid my A-levels. Then I somehow managed to get into the fourth best university in the country at the time, UCL. I did really well in my first year. Then I got bored and I couldn't learn, and I failed my second year. So I repeated that. I left after 4 years without a degree. I've tried an MBA. I've tried an MSc. I've never finished any of them. So that's partly down to my liking of shiny toys and not being a complete finisher. It's also down to the fact I don't learn in traditional ways. And the amount of entrepreneurs you talk to that you find out are dyslexic, because you see things very differently to other people. You process things very differently. And so that's where you spot the opportunities. Because if you're just doing what everyone else is doing, you've got to spend more money or be better than them or whatever. Whereas if you see something that no one else is doing, it's very easy to suddenly become the best in class. So that's the plus side. The bad side is, well, all of a sudden I get kicked out of school because I'm messing around and I end up doing something wrong, and then it escalates and escalates, and then I'm on death row in America. And you know, they're two real extremes. But for 80% of death row people to be dyslexic, and 60%, you know, there's 10% of people in the world are dyslexic on average. So 80% is a huge, you know, increase there, and 60% of self-made millionaires is a huge increase. So, yeah, I digress a little bit, but that's something you might not know about me as a business leader, that, you know, I left without a degree, I left after a year of A-levels, and yeah, I struggle with things like that.
And thank you for sharing that, because I think that's a really lovely story around you are what you make of it, right? Like, you can have similar difficulties, similar circumstances, and choose, now, albeit there's support, there's different support systems in there and all of that, but that you can make things out of things that are really difficult. So I think that's a really lovely message to end on.
Yeah, and one of my goals now is to be an example of what's possible. That's why when I said earlier, I hate the word lucky, for exactly that reason. You know, luck doesn't come into it. I was fortunate to have a really supporting family, but I worked ridiculously hard to get to where I am now. And it's, you know, you talk about me not being a complete finisher. I set this business up 12 years ago with me and two interns, and I did every single job in the company because I had to. So you can do it if you want to, but it's just not me and my flow. So it goes back to those things that you make your own luck. And I don't like luck because of that. You're fortunate that anyone else could do what I do. That's why I love going and seeing inspiring people, because I think they're no different to you or me. If they can do it, what's to stop me doing it?
Yeah, you can take that. Well, we are looking forward to seeing where your journey heads. And please stop by Newcastle on route to Edinburgh if you ever find an opportunity. We'd love to see you. But also, we'll watch with interest on where you and the business go in the future. Thanks for joining us, Spencer.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
So let's wrap up with a few takeaways from a great episode with Spencer. The first being around critical numbers. Spencer talked about sharing the four critical numbers that they have and the KPIs that sit underneath it. But what he shared about the way they communicate them was really interesting. They communicate them in various different ways and take into account how people need to receive those critical numbers and those KPIs to be able to resonate with them. Linking from that, he talked about the value of personal BHAGs, and that was something we loved, that yes, you'll have your BHAG as a company, but then understanding the personal BHAGs of each of your employees and then being able to help support with that will only increase engagement. And finally, we talked all the way through about gold medal winners, but I think it's such an important takeaway for people to bear in mind that gold medal winners will want to work with other gold medal winners. So that ability to hold true to your values and not compromise on that is something that's going to be really, really important if you want to create a high-performing team across the board.
Thank you for listening to Misbehave. Follow us so you don't miss out on other episodes.